Thank you, Kim Gordon. It is 12:09 Monday in Chicago. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for joining us. A little bit later, Suzanne Muchin, the co-host of The Big Payoff, will be in the studio. Often she's here on Tuesdays, but a little bit later, a different schedule this week. So Suzanne comes in later in the program. Also, Mike Burt, who's the chief marketing officer for Grunt Style. That is a line of clothing for grunts, for members of the military. So we'll talk about the marketing issues there. Aaron Fitzgerald is the Senior Vice President for Global Sustainability for the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy. It's her job to follow milk production from grass to glass. That's her phrase. I just stole it. And keep the carbon footprint to a minimum. Aaron, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks so much, Steve. I'm excited to be here.
How about that? I like that. From grass to glass.
Yeah. That's right.
And tell me what the idea of it is. Then you're following and keeping the footprint as small as you can.
Right. So the whole idea is to really think about, you know, where our food comes from and all the environmental impacts of growing that food, again, from the production of the soils all the way to the end of the consumer use and experience, and sometimes even throwing it away.
I read that milk production has quadrupled since 1944. Greenhouse gas emissions have actually been cut by 63% over that time. So how does that happen? I mean, is that, I'm wondering if that's a more recent trend toward cutting emissions or if it's been a long sort of long time effort.
It's a really great question because we've been working with our farmers. The first thing we did was we said, we need to measure our carbon footprint. And as we started hearing about this carbon environmental impact, you know, our farmers have been committed to the land for generations. And
right,
they're saying,
right.
What is that, you know, word, sustainability? And so the first thing we did is we started measuring this carbon footprint. And we found that the dairy industry is really responsible for 2% of total carbon emissions. But more importantly, we found that there's had been this trend line of reducing carbon footprint. We said, well, wow, that was before that word,
Was it just happening naturally?
Well, it had been working because if you look at the 25 variables that a farm actually, that impact environmental, both environmental performance, both carbon and water, they're the same 25 variables that many of our farmers have been managing for generations. So we said, if we could look at our past, that could help be a predictor for the future.
So when you talk about these 25 variables, you're talking about the way the farmer does his or her job every day. These are the things that they use and have functions that they use to run a farm. So why don't we focus on those and see how we can do those a bit more compactly, correct?
Exactly.
What kind of things are we talking about?
Yeah,
here?
So innovative things like herd management, the way we feed our cows, and then yield performance, and then optimizing. You know, we have this great thing called manure, and everyone's
right.
Like, oh, well, what's manure? But, you know, manure is actually this thing called brown gold. I mean, it has incredible...
It's not called, you know, brown gold in many places.
Well, many of our farmers, we call it brown gold, and because it has this great soil fibers that can use to be a soil amendment, and then also has natural fertilizers.
When we're talking about carbon gas, we're talking about methane, aren't we?
Yes.
I mean, that's the big thing.
Right.
I remember there was a movement a few years ago by the vegetarian crowd saying that we should become vegetarians to save the earth because so much of the carbon gas emissions come from out of the back end of a car, our cow, worldwide, correct?
Well, it's so funny. To me, comparing a cow to a car is the wrong question.
I just did it accidentally.
And so, you know, that's saying that fossil fuel-based emissions versus emissions that are from the biospace are comparable, and they're really not. You cannot compare a non-renewable resource to one that's cycling carbon. You know, food and the ability to have a cow and what that cow is providing, it's cycling carbon. And the cow eats over 180 different feedstuffs, and that's all food products that would otherwise be thrown into a landfill, right? So it's able to cycle that carbon and produce nutrient-dense food.
Okay, I get that. So it's a more noble carbon emissions gas
than
what comes out of the back of a
car.
You
can't compare the two.
But it still comes out of the back of a cow, and it still is an issue, and farmers are finding ways to harness that, which I think is just a beautiful thing. Explain that for me.
Yeah, well,
wait a minute. I want to use the term first because I wrote it down. Where is it? Where did I write it? An anaerobic digester.
Yeah. So
how about that?
There's two emissions. It's not the back always. Actually, the cow belches when they chew their cud. But at the back end, the manure, there's this thing that we're finding with anaerobic digestion is taking the manure and you know, composting, right? So composting takes food and bacteria And you're able to create a soil amendment or natural fertilizer from that. But what happens is you lose some of that energy that goes in the air. Well, digesters actually close the lid, if you will, like put it in a jar, and allows the anaerobic digestion process to happen. And what you get out of it is methane gas. And you're able to scrub that methane gas and create two things. Concentrated natural gas that you can combust and put in an electrical generation and a line, or inject it right into a natural gas line, or put it into as a CNG truck.
So you can run a truck on cow manure.
We call it green gas. And there are some people that are doing that already.
You've got some colorful names. You've got brown gold. You've got green gas. But so obviously you can't contain the belch because that's goes.
Yeah.
But the manure, some of these farms are built to where you catch it right away. You cap it, so any emission out of that is capped and then converted into fuel.
Yes.
Now, is this pie in the sky stuff, or is it actually happening?
No, it's actually happening. I mean, we have over 200 farms across the country that are doing it. And in Germany and the Nordics, you see it quite often.
Is that right?
Yeah. No,
I cheated a little bit. I do know it's happening because I've read about Fair Oaks Farms.
Yes.
And, you know, my daughter goes to school in Ohio, so we were up and down I-65. When I grew up in Manteno, which is a little bit west of there. But my parents would take my kids when they were young to Fair Oaks Farms. They'd see calves being born. And I just kind of assumed it was just a really big dairy operation with a show. I did not know about all of this that they do, and they're kind of a leader in all of this, right?
Yeah, they basically took the anaerobic digestion, and then in the state of Indiana, the renewable portfolio standards not as high, so it didn't really work to put the electricity back onto the grid. But what it did work was to take that natural gas and combust it, and you know that we move milk every single day to a grocery store, right? So what you're seeing there is Fair Oaks has a great partnership with Kroger, actually, and to get the milk off the farm, they're putting it into natural gas into their milk trucks.
So the Kroger trucks are going to Fair Oaks Farms. They're getting loaded up with milk and with gas.
Correct.
Both from the same cow.
Yep.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's definitely a closed-loop system.
It is a closed-loop. And also one of the things you work on is then adding other food waste. Because I read that, too, and it was from you somewhere, but like 40% of food in the U.S. is eventually consumed. The rest is not, right,
yeah,
in one way or another. So how do you take that and harness that?
Yeah, one of the biggest things related to climate change is that we are harvesting wonderful food from our lands, but it's not going to the right place. We're not honoring that harvest.
It's just not being eaten well?
Being eaten well. You know, people are eating not the right things, right? And then what they are eating, they're throwing it away, or they're not getting it to people in their community who need it.
Uh-huh.
So when you think about, you know, enhancing a sustainable food system, number one, we want to make certain you're eating the right things and not taking too much, right? That's also a problem.
Sure.
And then getting it to people in your community, and then if it can't, it can't be used, don't throw it away. The minute it goes into that landfill, you're now adding to that methane gas problem. And what we want to do is divert that food waste into composting, and then obviously digesters is even better because now you're able to do renewable energy plus fertilizer.
Are there digesters around that do that with food scraps and food waste?
There are. There's a great story in Massachusetts that we've been working with. I can add that to a website for you guys.
Okay, great.
That's a great story. But you're starting to see that a lot more, where we're looking at creating these bio-villages where you have food waste plus the manure that is generating renewable energy.
You'll
and
never
fertilizer.
Have to leave your couch.
Yeah, I guess.
That is Aaron Fitzgerald Saxon with us today. She is the Senior Vice President for Global Sustainability for the Innovation Center for U.S. Dairy, and there's no room on her card for any other words. Thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it. We learned
a lot.
Thank you. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Well, 22, it's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Suzanne Mushin is the co-host of The Big Payoff. You can hear that podcast at WGNplus.com. And she joins us usually once a week or so to talk about the issues of women in the workplace. And she's on a phone line this afternoon. Suzanne, welcome back to the program. I'm sorry, Suzanne. Give me one sec. There we go. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I can do this now since you're not here. If I don't like what you're saying, I can just slide down.
I know, but the problem is I can't see the eye roll.
Oh, look, it worked. I just did it. Okay. I'm sorry. What were you saying? Where are you today? You're in New York?
No, I'm here in Chicago, but couldn't make it into the studio.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I understand. Now, you know, we talk about women in the workplace, women in tech, and whenever we do that, it's always, we got to get more. There needs to be more. There aren't enough women in tech. And sometimes it's a good idea just to take stock, step back, and say, there maybe are more than we thought.
This is kind of an amazing moment, I think, for women in tech in Chicago. And you are right. And I hold myself accountable for this, too, that too often our conversations about women in tech are, boo-hoo-hoo, there's not enough, we need to get more in. But this week, Chicago Inno, which is a great publication online.
I love the Inno boys. They come in once in a while.
Fantastic. And Ms. Tech, which is a networking group for women in tech, published this comprehensive list of women founders in Chicago's tech space. And Steve, there are pages and pages. I went to try to print it out for us today. I mean, this list went on. And while we hear the number that Chicago's doing really great, we have one of the highest percentage of women founders at 30%, seeing this list answers a lot of questions about where are the women? Here they are.
Okay, so 30% of tech founders in Chicago are women. Is that the statistic?
Yeah.
And that's higher than the national average?
National average is around 18%.
Okay, so almost double. We'll take double there. It's not quite that. But the thing about it, I think you're going to say, is it's not just the quantity, it's the quality, that there are some real players here. Tell me about some of your favorites.
So I love Anna Stark and her Luminade, which is people who watch Shark Tank might have seen it. They're those inflatable lights that you can use in disasters, and they're solar powered. It's just an incredibly smart, what we'd call a social enterprise type project, right? Because it does well and does good and makes money. They did great on Shark Tank. And then I love, you know, longstanding entrepreneur Talia Mashiach, who was the founder of Evid. The reason that Talia is interesting is because it's a B2B business play. It's management software. We tend to think of women in tech as doing all these kind of women's products and beauty and purses with chargers and
child care and things like that.
Exactly. But Talia is a great example of women who are actually right at the heart of the tech scene, doing the heavy lifting of B2B and doing it really, B2B meaning business to business, and doing it really well.
Okay, before we go, I want to talk to you too about the Justin Trudeau visit. He was at the White House last week, and you know, I mean, people were sort of gaga over him. We've talked about him before because he's got this commitment to having a 50-50 cabinet, 50% women, 50% men, which I don't like too much. I mean, I would love it if it happens naturally.
No, you don't.
Well, I would love it if it happened organically, but I don't like the idea of maybe sacrificing an overqualified woman for an underqualified man just to make it 50-50 or the other way around. Anyway.
I know that's your point of view. Okay. I get it.
So what'd you think of his visit?
So he is the JFK of Canada. People adore him, and he's earned it. He's smart, he's charismatic, and he is very much what they're calling a feminist president. And even though we can say, well, the how he got his cabinet to be gender neutral, gender equal might not have been the best way, in your point of view, what we can say is, he's really inspiring women to step up and lead in political positions. And as we approach our elections here tomorrow, Steve, anybody who looks at the ballot will see there's definitely a need. Once you get down below the, you know, obvious Hillary Clinton on the list, we need a lot more women in office. And one of the messages he gave out last week, which I loved, was it really is important to draw women into the political system. They're not necessarily out there just raising their hand.
Because
he says they
just have a different approach than men, that men are like, well, of course you need me. Women are more like, oh, really? You think I could help?
That was a great example. So he said, look, if I ask a woman to step up and to join my cabinet or to run for a position, she'll say, really? Do you think I'm qualified? And if you ask a guy, he'll say, sure, why didn't you ask me before?
Yeah, I think that's a generalization, obviously. But
Steve.
Isn't there some irony? He's super cute.
Super cute.
And he's getting a lot of this pub and play when he comes to Washington because he's super cute.
Okay, that is very, very... Now, talk about... If this had been the other way around...
That's my point.
Imagine if we were talking
exactly
about a woman.
That's exactly my point.
That's not why he's getting attention,
yes,
Steve.
Is. Oh, sure it is. He's coming in. They're making jokes about him and Justin Bieber. If he looked like his old man, he would not be nearly as endearing as he is because he's handsome.
Okay, well, his old man was kind of handsome, too.
See, there you go. But are you going to give me that a little bit?
I was being ironic. You would have seen my eye roll.
But isn't there something to that, Suzanne? I mean, you know, okay. We're not supposed to treat
Absolutely.
People by their look, but we do treat him that way, too.
We do. And here's one of those, does the end justify the means? If it takes having a good-looking, charismatic world leader to put these messages out into the world so that people pay attention to them, as long as he's sincere about it, I think that's okay.
We're out of time, I'm sorry to say, but maybe we can bring this up next week. And then when we do, we'll play the Canadian National Anthem under you as you talk.
Awesome.
Suzanne Mishan, the co-host, you bet, the co-host of The Big Payoff on WGN+. Thank you, Kim Gordon. 12:37 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand in on a Monday afternoon. Not too shabby. Tomorrow is primary day, and there could be some storms around late in the day, so get up and vote early. Vote often. Why not? You're in Chicago. All right, let's put some clothes on. Have you heard of the clothing style, Grunt Style, this new clothing line? They're not so new, really. Mike Burt is the chief marketing officer, and he joins us on a phone line now. Mike, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right. Grunt Style Clothing is the name of the company is called Grunt Style. Tell me about that. What exactly is that?
So we are a military style clothing brand. We started in 2009 by our owner, Daniel Alaric, when he was a drill sergeant down at Fort Benning, Georgia. He knew he was getting out of the Army soon and was going to be coming back to Chicago. Had just gotten married, had a baby, and wanted to start a business and do something that he could still, you know, find a way to be as part of a team that he really enjoyed about the military, be able to show his pride in himself, in his country, and in the military.
But the idea
so
that
he started this clothing brand.
And Grunt, the brand, Grunt has to do with the grunts in the military, right?
Correct. He was an infantryman in the military. Most of us here, I think we're about 60% veteran here, and most of that 60% were infantry, either Marine or Army infantry. So it's heavily themed across our company here.
So I wasn't in the military and certainly not a grunt. Could I still buy your clothes?
Most definitely. We stand for pride in self, pride in military, pride in country. You don't have to be a veteran to exhibit those things.
I don't know if you want me wearing your shirts, though, Mike. I might not be much of an advertisement. I don't think I'd look very good in them.
Well, you know, I don't get put in the ads either. So, you know, there's a reason why we have our models. But, anyone can wear those things. It's just about having pride.
How long have you been with Daniel?
I have been here for 2 years now.
Okay. Tell me a little bit of the story. I mean, you mentioned it, that he knew he was getting out of the military and needed to find something to do. I know he said that a lot of the jobs that he might have been drawn to, he didn't think was going to fit the skills he was bringing with him. But tell me a little bit about the genesis of the company, how it went from just him, I think, and then his wife, and grew from there.
So that's a big part of his decision, was knowing when you're getting out of the military, how am I going to fit back into civilian society? So it's very different. And the transition getting out of the military is difficult. So he wanted to start something on his own then and see if he could grow it and provide a place for veterans to be able to come to when they get out of the service and want to still fit in and feel like they're part of a team and moving towards a mission.
So he started Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Started out of his house at Fort Benning, Georgia. We started pretty much as just a graphic t-shirt company, and he was printing shirts out of his apartment in Columbus, Georgia, you know, here and there for some friends, and then started selling at one of the stores on base, and he has just grown steadily since then.
And he's you guys are headquartered, is it in Carroll Stream now?
That's correct. We're out in Carroll Stream, so we moved into a new facility here. We have 50,000 square feet here in Carroll Stream. So
50,000 square feet.
In my time, even, it's grown quite a bit. We used to have a little place up in Schaumburg.
I was reading online, though, where he had sort of a timeline of the development. And I think it was in 2012 where he went to some sort of convention or show. And mm-hmm. that was like the crossroads for him. If it didn't go well there, he was going to close shop.
That was it. He was at the end of the road and, you know, had to make a decision. Do I keep going after this or, you know, do I have to refocus? So he went to a trade show out in Las Vegas and promised his wife, who is our chief financial officer now, that if he didn't make at least $6,000,
Mike, I got news
for
you.
He would shut it down and get a real job.
I got news for you. They're all our chief financial officers.
That's true. And she runs both books. She actually gets to keep the title here. So that's for sure. It was an easy transition for her.
Things went well, and now you got 50,000 square feet. Does he design the clothing, or do you have designers? How does that come about?
We have a design team now. So in the beginning, it was him doing it. But as we've grown, we've been able to add more and more positions and provide more opportunity for people. You know, so like I said, we have about 60% of us who are veterans here of about 100 employees. So, you know, we are trying to hire first and foremost veterans as often as we can and when they come in the door. So we do have our own team of designers, and we design everything ourselves.
Mostly shirts, or what items of clothing are for sale?
So we do graphic T-shirts is where we started at. So that's kind of our bread and butter. But this year we have begun an expansion. We have a casual line for business casual, so polos and button downs, things people can wear to work. We have an athletic line now as well where we have things for the gym. We've also become a golf line. So we're selling we went to the PGA show this year. It was a big step for us, and we're selling it at golf courses now. And then we have gear as well. So we'll sell different types of gear like body armor or bags or, you know, gun carriers, that kind of thing. So we're really expanding and adding a lot more products as we continue to grow.
I'm interested, too, in the genesis of the company in that there was sort of a decision to make it less military-centric and more sort of military-inspired or more patriotic, if you will, to sort of move away from just military a couple of years ago. And that really resulted in a big payoff for the company, didn't it?
It really did. And I think that is where you can take a look at our biggest uptick beginning. Was about 2.5 years ago when we made that decision to stop being 100% focused on it. So we'll never leave the military or veteran space, you know, but we did try to expand and have more outreach into the civilian world, you know, so we can reach those customers as well.
Is this a
we realize, too, there's people who have that same thing. You know, they have the same pride that we do.
Well, okay, that's a good point. And is there competition? Is this becoming sort of a niche? I mean, what, there's Ranger Up, there's Article 15 clothing that maybe compete with you, or is it sort of a sub-niche of the clothing industry that's becoming military or pro-USA clothing?
So those two guys have been around for a while, too. There are a few others that operate in this space. There is a very solid military clothing niche out there. There are several companies who do a good job doing what we do as well. We're friends with all those folks. We know them very well, too.
Oh, come on. You want to beat them.
It's a bit of a different business world. We always want to win, you know, and all of us do. But we do have good relationships with everybody. You know, we want to win, but we recognize at the same time, I think there's space for everybody.
What percentage of your customers?
It definitely pays to be a winner.
What percentage of your customers are military or past military?
It's probably about 50-50 right
now. Okay, well, that's pretty good.
Who are military. So, you know, it's certainly a very high percentage. And then they're either military or they've gotten out of the military recently, or more likely they're a first level connection to somebody in the military. So my brother, sister served, my mom, my dad, somebody in their family.
So when you give Christmas presents, do they all come from the Grunt clothing line?
Oh, of course they do. Yeah.
Because you get the discount,
right?
I
have to support the brand. I am a company man.
I appreciate that.
All the
Mike,
way.
Mike Burt, the Chief Marketing Officer for Grunt Style Clothing. Look, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate that.
Hey, Steve, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And good luck. Hello to everyone in Carroll Stream.
Thank you very much. I sure will.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Art, have you ever heard of the name Go, the game Go? I had not, but it's one of the things that we're talking about this week with Shara Tipkin, a senior writer at CNET. Shara, welcome back to The Business Lunch.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Art, did you know about the game Go?
No.
Well, I feel a little better than
before
yeah.
this. No,
so,
no.
Apparently Go is this game that's a very difficult, intricate game, and mm-hmm. it's one that's been a challenge for computer makers to build a computer that can play, right? We know about playing chess, but Go is a bit more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's infinitely harder than chess, actually. And there's too many different possibilities for somebody to be able to program a computer to actually just know the different possibilities. So it's more that the computer has to learn to play the game strategically instead of just kind of knowing, you know, having pre-programmed options. So it really shows whether this machine could learn, and, you know, it showed it really could.
And so, right, so now there's this match between a South Korean Go player, who I suppose is probably better than you and I, or you and me.
A little bit, yeah. Playing, he's number two in the world, yeah.
Number two in the world, playing this computer, and the computer company proved that they could do it. The computer did pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. So they were doing a series of five different games, and the computer has, you know, won all of them until this weekend. The South Korean player actually finally won, which is great. So it shows that, you know, we can still beat the machines, but
it just takes us a while.
Yeah. And the last game is today, so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so the player we're referring to, his name is Lee Sedol, I'll say. That's how I would pronounce it, Lee Sedol. And so he's what? He's 1-3, and they're playing game five today.
He's 1-4, actually.
1-4,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so this is the final one. So, I mean, he's lost it, but it was great to see that he was actually able to come back and win one. And I think he kind of changed his strategy completely, is what it looks like he did.
It's funny you say that, because it kind of reminds me of when my kids were in T-ball and they finally connected, you know, after missing
exactly.
All day. Oh, nice try. You did it. Well, you won one out of four, one out of five.
Yeah, it was like, yay, it's not all over for us.
But what is it? Okay, aside from playing Go, what does this sort of technology or this sort of development in computers mean for our future?
Yeah, I mean, if you even just look at your smartphone, companies are just trying to make these much smarter. You know, Google has Google Now and different features that, you know, will try to predict what you want. Like if you're in your car, it will know you're in your car and you're driving, and it will suggest gas stations or, you know, remind you to pick up your dry cleaning or different things like that. And it's all just, you know, trying to have machines help us do things and be smarter and predict things and learn. And, you know, it's not, you know, robots taking over the world yet, but it's, you know, just trying to make our machines smarter and take away some of the work that we have to do.
All right. Well, the computer has proven that it's not too shabby, so I'm rooting for Lee here in game six today. I would imagine you write for CNET. You always have a phone in your pocket or in your hand or a laptop on your lap, right? Can't get away from it.
No, definitely can't get away from it.
Which is why, Shara, when you finally come to Chicago and I take you out for a drink, we will not be going to Violet Hour.
So this is a bar in Chicago, you know, which actually sounds like a great bar, where one of their rules, along with no light beer, is you can't use a phone there. It's really interesting to see this sort of thing. I know a lot of people that will have this policy with their family where no phones at the dinner table or something like that. But it really is kind of this backlash of everybody's on their phone all the time. If you walk down the street in San Francisco, 9 out of 10 people you'll pass have their phone in their hand. They're looking down. They're not really paying attention. This is just kind of trying to get people to be there when they're there and be present and, you know, be with their friends and not disturb other people by talking loudly on their phone or Instagramming every drink or,
there is something about actually being there. And so often we're not really there. I'll tell you, I was just my daughter is in a sorority at the University of Dayton. So I was down there this weekend and a lot of parents were there and, you know, the parents don't know each other. And, you know, I'm more guilty than anyone. But the defense mechanism is when you are a little uncomfortable or you don't really want to engage, you take out the phone and you check if you have any phantom emails or you check your emails or you do whatever. But when you do that, you leave the world. I mean, you leave where you are. And the Violet Hour is just one of the places that's trying to make it a little bit harder for us to do that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm guilty of this all the time. You know, if you're early for something, waiting on someone is so easy to just, you know, pull out your phone. So you don't feel like a loser who's just, you know, by themselves. But it really does, I find sometimes, you become a little too dependent on it.
I will say this, Oshara. You know, Mr. Lee in South Korea is very good at Go, and that's fine. You know, he beat the computer once. I often can beat the computer at solitaire, just so you know.
That's good.
So when I take my phone out, I mean, I am distributing some skills as well. Tell me about these. We're riffing on an article written in CNET about different sorts of companies, outfits. There's a restaurant in Texas, I think, that does it as well. But I want to talk about Camp Grounded, which sounds pretty cool. And there's not just one of them, right? There are Camp Groundeds around the country. Is that the case?
I think so. Okay. It's really interesting that they've taken this concept of, you know, sleepaway camp, but for adults, and they have they make people put aside all of their electronics to kind of just be able to focus instead of, you know, constantly being connected on those sort of things. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's kind of scary thinking of, you know, going to sleepaway camp, let alone going to sleepaway camp without, you know, without your smartphone.
Let alone going to sleepaway camp in your 50s, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a pretty interesting experiment. And, you know, for these people, it really is a way to finally just disconnect. Because, I mean, I don't know how many times I've gone on vacation and I check my work email every day, you know, all the time I'm checking it. And it's almost a blessing when you get to go places where you don't have very good cell reception.
Well, tell me there's a guy that the Levi Felix is quoted in this and paraphrased in this article. And he said something I think that is genius. And it describes me. You know, he said, we become lighter and lighter in our conversations, fluffier and fluffier. There's less substance in our interaction. I mean, I have a friendship where friendships where I used to see people and actually talk to them every day. We used to converse if we had to say something. And then we emailed, you know, and that wasn't talking, but at least it was long form. And now we text. Our friendship is a texting friendship, and there's nothing. It just... that doesn't work. I mean, it's, you know, it's 72 letters, 200 letters, whatever. We're no longer really saying anything to each other while we're talking at each other more and more.
Yeah, I mean, just wait till your communication is all Snapchat and Instagram, you know, where it's not even words. It's just, you know, photos.
That go away in 20 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm glad you stayed with us for a little bit longer than that. Shara Tibkin, senior writer for CNET. It was nice to talk to you. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.